If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at OnePeloton.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to the Borderlines Podcast, the podcast for the discussion of Canadian immigration law and policy. I'm Steve Murins. This week, Deanna Okanachoff and I are joined by Raj Sharma, an immigration lawyer in Calgary at Stewart Sharma Harsanyi. Raj previously appeared on episode 48 of this podcast, where he discussed responding to procedural fairness letters, and also episode 3, where he discussed marriage fraud. And today, Raj is on to discuss his case, Mohammed v. Canada Citizenship and Immigration, which is the first federal court decision of 2022. There, the federal court ruled that the Immigration Appeal Division unreasonably minimized the extent to which working as a frontline healthcare worker during the COVID-19 pandemic should be a factor in the humanitarian and compassionate assessment. We also discuss processing times, mandamus applications, whether IRCC made a mistake in lumping federal skilled worker class and Canadian experience class applicants together in express entry, and more. Raj can be found on Twitter at imlawyercanada, immlawyercanada, all one word. And if you enjoyed today's episode and you like the show, please leave a review on iTunes or wherever you listen to your podcasts. I hope you enjoy.
We're 2 years into 2 weeks to flatten the curve, 2 years to 2 weeks for IRCC to digitize applications and respond to COVID. Raj, you have the first federal court case of the year, Mohammed v. Canada Citizenship and Immigration 2022 FC1. Congratulations on the first reported decision of 2022. And I think it'd be a good guide or a good case to kind of summarize where we are 2 years into COVID. But actually, before we get to that, did you see that they finally replaced the blue horizontal bar with a green vertical bar as part of their digitization efforts to modernize client service?
What are you talking about?
Did you see it, Raj, on Twitter? They had Sean Fraser on Twitter. They announced that for family class applications, you can now see the progress of your application, and it's a green vertical bar instead of the current blue horizontal bar.
The more things change, the more they stay the same. Call me as a skeptic or call me cynical, perhaps after 17, 18 years of practicing in this area and trying to explain to my clients for the umpteenth time that processing times may not be actually indicative of reality. Let's you know, the proof of the pudding is in the eating of the pudding.
Someone who responded to their tweet that said, but we never cared about the color of the bar. We just want our relatives to come to Canada.
Most probably. Oh my God, that's awesome.
Part of the problem is the lack of transparency. Oh, sorry. Oh. Go ahead, Deanna.
No, I had a client who wrote to me and was like, oh, good news. They're going to get on processing times. And I was like, okay, you know, just wait. Just don't send your invites out for the party just yet.
Don't sell the farm yet.
But why don't we talk about your case? Because I thought it does tie into an aspect of COVID. You know, we hear a lot about processing times, the border issues. But your case dealt with kind of how frontline COVID workers are treated in the humanitarian and compassionate context. So do you maybe want to like summarize Hauna Mohammed's background and found herself needing a lawyer?
Yeah, Bhavna Mohammed, and this, to some degree, I'm going to put this down as some degree of overconfidence on my part. And perhaps that sneaks in once you do a certain number of cases or litigation. And every now and then you encounter that sort of reality, which is the assessment was incorrect. I mean, ultimately proven correct at the federal court. So Bhavna Mohammed was a permanent resident of Canada. She had come here many years ago as an international student. She graduated. She worked in Canada in as a health aide. Things didn't work out. It was a little bit harder to navigate from temporary residence to permanent residence back when she did it around 2010, 2011. Ended up going back to Fiji, reconnected with and got sponsored to Canada by her first husband. And so she became a permanent resident. She accumulated quite a number of days in Canada and working in Canada. And then marriage breaks down, reconnects with the old boyfriend, ends up making this sort of significant decision of going to the US and ends up getting married. So her, you know, boyfriend, husband is Muslim. His parents are like, no, we're not going to do this dating thing. You're going to get married. So ends up getting married, gets some sort of shoddy advice, which is you can regularize your status from within the US. Husband's a green card holder. I had to ask my own brother about this. My brother's a US immigration lawyer, but in essence, she should have done something called consular processing instead of trying to navigate the system from within the US. She ultimately gets refused and comes back to Canada at the port of entry with her expired PR card, and she's written up for non-compliance of the residency obligation. Everyone is probably familiar that you need to have 2 years. It's this use it or lose it type of provision. You got to be in Canada 2 years out of a five-year period. She's way short. We run the appeal. In the meantime, she's a healthcare aide. She starts working at Bethany Care in Airdrie. There's been a massive outbreak. COVID happens. We run the appeal. So I look at this appeal to go to the IAD. She's got lots of family in Canada. She's studied in Canada. She's, you know, but for this mistake or this shoddy advice, she wouldn't be in the situation that she is right now. So all of the classic Rubik and Chu factors were there other than really best interests of a child. I looked at her service in the time of a pandemic where we're, you know, beating pots and pans on balconies in support of frontline healthcare workers. And so I made that the centerpiece of my appeal. And so I had letters from Bethany. I put in information about the outbreak there, the deaths of residents there. Like, really, she's there for the most vulnerable at the most vulnerable time when their own family members couldn't be there for while they were dying, for example. She's dealing with dead bodies. She's dealing with feeding people. She's dealing with, you name it, she's dealing with it, with people that have dementia again. And so I made that the centerpiece of the appeal. And I really thought, okay, well, you know, we've all done residency appeals. And a lot of them are this sort of like these Western songs, like my dog died, my wife left me and whatever, right? And so they're not that compelling sometimes because most times when you lose your status and you lose at the IAD, it's because of choices outside that you've made, not because of extenuating circumstances that you chose. And so, you know, you've picked, you know, now you got to lie, you picked your bed, now lie in it. And so this was truly compelling. And again, most residency appeals are fail at the IAD. I made it the centerpiece, and we got this strange decision from the board member, which was that, yeah, I give it, you know, I give this moderate weight, I give this some weight, I give this some moderate positive weight. And we took it to federal court, had Justice Emmett.
Raj, sorry.
It was member Stephanie Pinto, and you know, Stephanie and I, we worked together at the IRB 20 years ago. She was a case officer at that time. She then became a hearings officer. So even seeing Stephanie, I felt confident. I had the CBSA officer who's, again, just has never seen any appeal that she's liked, you know, an officer that I've done a complaint against in the past. And so, you know, again, I was like, okay, she's going to be over the top. And, you know, my client is very compelling and very credible, and I've got all of the evidence and I've got a good draw. Lo and behold, I get this refusal, went to the federal court. We got a very good decision. And I remember telling the federal court justice that, and again, I've got this DOJ lawyer on the other side. I quoted Justice Harrington, who quoted from Shakespeare, Titus Andronicus, in a case. And the DOJ lawyer interrupts and she's like, you know, excuse me, you know, I've never heard counsel quote from Shakespeare before. And it's Justice Emmett. And Justice Emmett's like, well, there's a first time for everything.
That's amazing.
I then start talking about what she has to do as a healthcare aide in Bethany Care. And I'm like, this is very difficult work. This moral debt that we owe these individuals is not easily, quantifiable. This is not something that we can put into words exactly. And how does that board member deal with it? I'm like, this work is so difficult. I could not do this work. I said that. Again, she interrupts. She's like, I object. Counsel should not be expressing their personal opinions. At this point, and I'm just quiet. And I just waiting to see Justice Emmett's response. And Justice Emmett's like, Mr. Sharma, I want to hear more of your opinion on this matter.
Oh my goodness. Raj, this is amazing.
So yeah, and I'm just like, and the only thing is like, you know, don't gild the lily, Raj, right? And I'm just like, okay, just bring this home now. Just bring this home. Everything's done. And then the decision was as good or perhaps better as what I expected. That moral debt was there. So finally, like, you know, again, let's not just pay lip service to the front line, the essential care workers. There was evidence before Justice Emmett in terms of the impact on racialized immigrant women that took the brunt of it. So in Toronto, for example, they were disproportionately affected by COVID and infected by COVID during the worst outbreaks. So we had that evidence before the IAD itself. So we had this disproportionate impact on racialized immigrant women, which is Bhavna Muhammad. So we had everything there. And so here I will castigate myself a little bit on the IAD that perhaps I was overconfident on this one exceptional factor. Ultimately, I was proven correct. This time around, it's obviously going back to the IAD. So we will address more of the typical Ribic and Chu factors, which never really work in residency appeals, but we will now cross the T's and dot the I's.
It's always unpredictable. That was the paragraph that leapt out at me when I read the case, and you alluded to it, which is paragraph 43, that quote, the moral debt owed to immigrants who worked on the front lines to help protect vulnerable people in Canada during the first waves of the COVID-19 pandemic cannot be understated. I do not find that the IAD gave this contribution the weight it deserved, end quote.
You should have seen Justice Emmett's, when I quoted, like I went through the transcript. CBSA hearings counsel said that my client essentially is working in this as a frontline healthcare worker to buttress her appeal. And I'm like, this is in the transcript. I'm like, let me get this straight. My client dealing with an unknown pathogen is going to put herself in harm's way, potentially risk her life just so she could potentially win an appeal that's a year or so in the future. So mind-boggling stuff. So again, I thought that I had it at the IAD, got a strange decision. You know, we had the federal court. So very, very, you know, very grateful for that decision. And I think, and the beauty of that decision is that 1 month after the, you know, in December, after I ran that argument in front of the federal court, I was in front of Stephanie Pinto again on an IED for MISREP, for a non-disclosed family member, for a young girl from Nepal who was working as a healthcare provider in a COVID facility, who graduated from, who studied in Canada. And I said to Stephanie Pinto, I said, you know, that last case we had, I have leave, and I just argued that in front of Justice Hamid. And I'm going to tell you that her contributions on the front lines is a significant factor, and you cannot underplay it. Fast forward, get the decision, sent it into the IAD post-hearing. It was accepted, as obviously was referenced in submission. So I believe Bhavna Muhammad is going to assist other cases. It's not going to be a lot, but it will come in handy.
I wouldn't underestimate it, Raj. I think that this is a really epic decision in so many ways. And first of all, just the way that you just articulated what you did in that was so brilliant that it really, I think it even elevated the decision itself, which was pretty spectacular. But for me, and you know, you're going to need to cut me off after a few minutes, but like, I just wanted to say that kind of my takeaways from both the decision and from also what you've said right now is that like we are working in truly Shakespearean times. And if you're not prepared to bring that level of I don't even know what you call it, but to your litigation, then you shouldn't be in front of a decision maker right now. Because, you know, you sort of, you said at one point that you've been castigating yourself because, oh, I didn't do this quite as well and da da da. But at the same time, it's just, that like, I know what you're saying when you talk about like, when I read it, you know, when I get the facts from my client and I sort of do a bunch of time, just making sure I've got the whole insides and outs of the case, I have a gut instinct as to how this is going to do. And usually my gut instinct is pretty spot on, and I'm not trying to like, you know, beat my own drum, but I just kind of mean like when you've been doing it for long enough and with enough cases, you're like, okay, this is a winner. But some of those winners are tanking, and you have to anticipate, even in what you like. I got in trouble with a client the other day because I was like, no, we're going to settle this case. Not only do we not settle it, we didn't get leave. I don't think I've been denied leave since I was an art club student, you know, like, yeah. I just was like, what's happening to me right now, you know? And so you can take nothing for granted.
Well, I think, you know, it was that UFC where doing the advocacy course, I think that in fact a lawyer and advocate should appropriately in the appropriate case should demonstrate passion and should be able to be eloquent. Yeah, that's true. A lot of lawyers won't quote Shakespeare, but I was actually referencing Sean Harrington, who quoted from Titus Andronicus, "Can you hear a good man groan and not relent and not compassion him?" That's it. You know, and you're trying to explain the Chirwa, you're trying to explain that, you know, the Chirwa concept of agency relief, and then, you know, the sort of convergence between Section 25 sub 1 and Section 67(1)(c) of the IAD, and where they came from, and how do we apply that, and what is the jurisdiction of the IAD. And there's other cases, which is that the IAD agency is not a quantifiable process, it's qualificative. I believe that's Justice Shore or Justice Zinn. And so one factor could be an overriding factor. So I agree. I mean, you know, we do have a good sense of it. And I'm glad that I was sort of vindicated. And the client is obviously, client was watching during the Zoom thing. So that was also... and, you know, just a note to other counsel, DOJ counsel, interrupted me a couple of times and then couldn't find something in her materials and then said, Raj, where is that document, Raj? What page is that document at? And again, Justice Ahmed, any justice would be like, firstly, it's not Raj, it's Mr. Sharma or my friend. And number two, he's like, you better find this on your own. And so maintain some degree of decorum. It's the federal court. I know we're doing everything on Zoom these days, but you know,
without a gown and all this kind of stuff, but it's still representations in front of the federal tribunal.
That's where the sort of experience I think probably comes in handy. Know who you're in front of, but I think, you know, know
who you're across from.
Yeah, perhaps.
I think so too, honestly. I do think so because, like, I do think so. Yeah. I think that there's, you can leave no stone unturned right now.
I think more senior DOJ would not have done what that counsel did. That's exactly my point. That much I can say.
In terms
but
of
I think that, also like you do need to bring every tool. So whether or not that means you're going to be literary, whether that means you need to be a bit theatrical, whether or not that means you need to be extremely political, I think you have to be prepared with all of that material, right down to the point of like, do not gloss over the affidavit is no longer just about showing the materials that were before the officer. I think you really need to up your game and be like, yes, but also consider this material that's like, you know, I think that, I when I am approaching litigation right now, I'm pretty confident in my own skills, but that doesn't mean I'm not speaking to my, you know, the three litigators or maybe the two litigators I have on speed dial to be like, would you do this differently? Am I missing something? Like we need, this is part of what's so challenging right now is we really need to collaborate and be like, oh, how did this work? Why did this work? You know, talking this through. I took Gordon Maynard for lunch the other day to be like, you need to set me straight because this is a hard case. And he was like, whoa, Martin, Gordon said, I don't get surprised much, but this one surprises me. And so we sat over lunch and just tore it apart.
All of those points are good. And I would say that also you should pick your battles.
Yeah.
And that may be more true for DOJ than us.
I'm going to come back to the case and some of the possible, you know, implications where it may also apply. Because I agree with Deanna, I could see this possibly having wide-ranging implications. But coming back to something Deanna just said about, you know, the affidavit not just being something where you stick to what was purely before the visa officer, something that I've kind of learned over the years is to take, you know, the federal court judges, when they present at CBA conferences, will often say, almost, you know, try to keep your applicant record as small as possible, try to keep your memorandum of argument as small as possible. And I have found over the years that I will regret what I didn't say much more than possibly putting too much into an applicant's record. And that was really driven home early at the IAD for me by the hearings counsel, who I won't name, but who is actually really good. And I would say made me a much better litigator there because he would just focus in all the time on what was missing from an applicant's record. And if the applicant, the appeal, I can't remember what it's called with the IAD, but like the material the applicant puts forward, the disclosure. And it was always, well, if the applicant cared more about their case, they would have made this more comprehensive. So I don't know.
I've seen a lot of that too, and at the board and at the federal court.
Yeah, like, so I don't know if you
why didn't you like explain better sentence? Why you're not sharing this information with your children? Like really getting into people's personal decisions and personal life, and you know, just feeding off of what you're saying, Steve, is that like I think that when you deal with the deference given to decision makers, they're allowed to take into consideration general country conditions, you know, like, and so, you know, that's not something that's on the record, but that will be part of the, I don't know if I'm making sense here, but that will be part of the reasonableness assessment. Like, was it unreasonable given what their deference is owed, given like they know country conditions? It seems to me that if there are assumptions being made about country conditions, you need to provide counter evidence to that. It's not something that, like, I don't know. I feel like this needs to kind of be thought through more specifically, more meaningfully, because like, don't just take for granted that because that evidence wasn't there, that, you know, talking about the risks that somebody would take working in the healthcare sector can't be something that you still argue. So I just think that like, really you need to take the blinders off and take the most broad spectrum approach to how you strategize around the case. And then to go off of something that Raj said too, like, you know, you were saying Raj about choose your battles, but I think the other kind of practice advice right now is that you need to be very different about managing your client expectations. And so like, what the cost might be. Like, you can quote your fees for an IAD, but if you're likely, if there's a real good chance you're going to lose at the IAD, and then you're going to have to start quoting fees for federal court application, like, you need to foreshadow this in your conversations with your client and repeatedly bring it up and just be like, we might not win here. And even though I think we've got a winning case, you might need to budget for both an IAD appeal and a federal court, and then going back to the visa office and then being refused again. And then having, you know, like, it's just like, it's just really hard to kind of think of all the things you need to at least open as a conversation with your client from the very beginning and just keep bringing back all the way through. The professional responsibility here is just like, it's real, real high.
So on the case, just swinging back then, as far as where it could apply, like, her NOC is, as a healthcare aide, is what the government would consider an unskilled NOC with no immediate pathway to permanent residence. So I guess, Raj, my question would be, do you see this decision as possibly forming a basis for, well, healthcare NOCs to claim H&C? You could expand it to the whole, like, all of the TRPR occupations is what the government considered essential to COVID-19. And do you think that this creates, I guess my question is, almost its own factor in an H&C assessment?
I think so. I think, you know, remember when we say, and I hate the word unskilled. I hate the word unskilled to describe NOC C&D occupations, because, you know, when you need them, they're essential workers. And when you sort of don't need them, then they're unskilled workers. I prefer the term low wage workers rather than unskilled workers. I had a discussion with Doug Saunders of the Globe and Mail about this. We have a Byzantine immigration system. COVID threw a wrench into an already cumbersome and inefficient machinery. And so you could have, for example, in Alberta, the AINP, you could have someone that provides, for my 93-year-old mother, someone that goes to her residence and assists her. She lives with my uncle in Edmonton. Someone that goes there and provides her assistance, same graduation from Alberta grad, that person is ineligible under the AOS, the Alberta Opportunity Stream. If that person is working in a residence care facility, on the other hand, as a home support worker, that person is. So again, this Byzantine rules that you have the same duties, but you do it in this location versus this location. This one's in, this one's out. You have accounts payable clerk who's a 1-4, that's NOC C. So 1 year working as accounts receivable or payable clerk at Sheraton Hotel, you're not in, you're NOC C for Canadian Experience Class. Now a bookkeeper at a 1-2, that person's in. So we have to get rid of this Byzantine system. That's the future. Now, can change happen? Obviously, sclerotic organizations like government departments don't like change, but COVID has forced change. And so we saw, for example, the TR to PR pathways, which was one of the silver linings of COVID. But COVID continues, and our processing continues to have significant human cost. I agree with you. They've moved it from a blue bar to a green bar, but people's lives are still hanging in the balance of that, whatever status bar, whatever color that status bar is.
There's so much packed into that, Raj, and it's really brilliant. I think that this thing, like, I've made a career out of making these arguments about the healthcare sector, like my whole obsession with the caregiver stuff and all the jurisprudence around that. So I feel like it's starting because of the, what you said, that when we need them, they're essential. When you don't, they're low skilled. Right now, anybody who's going to care for anybody under any circumstances is just essential. So to call them low skilled and C&D and fewer opportunities is kind of, it's primitive and archaic. Nick Keung, by the way, from the Toronto Star, has done some really, really good writing on this subject as well. And so, you know, in terms of the part that complicates it for me is this TR to PR pathway being one of the bright lines. Like, part of what we've been talking about in other episodes, and Steve and I have done this a whole bunch, is that, like, yes, it's a bright line, but it, you know, the numbers for that program carved out of the express entry. And I'm not saying that's a good thing or a bad thing, but it just has created this situation we're in right now, which is that there are enough people in the backlog to fill the entire quota for next year. And are they the right people even, you know, like we don't even know. So like, we're kind of hamstrung on this thing. And also people are like, you know, coming to Canada and paying hundreds of thousands of dollars on Canadian education with the expectation of a CEC pathway that may not exist when they get there, you know? So like, I think that the idea of like the total absence, or at least the appearance of the total absence of strategic planning from the department's perspective, like who are you going to bring in? Like, and the total lack of transparency, so people don't have any way of planning around this, is just like, it's epic.
Normally being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Well, and it's like the lack of transparency is part of what's really giving rise to the sense that there is no plan, like coming back forward, like the plan is just based on what can we do to hit a numbers target.
Sure. Maybe if you have a plan, maybe there is a plan. The plan, but if you're not telling anybody, it's like it's not of any value to the public.
The plan is that we're going to build a plane while we fly it. Mm-hmm. That's the plan. And I agree, in terms of transparency, almost a fifth of Canadians are immigrants. Immigration will have to do better. They got a pass. A lot of ink and tears have been spilled over the impact of the pandemic on immigration processing. But the pandemic, you can't keep beating this dead horse of the pandemic. Oh. We've had enough time to adjust. We have enough technology.
We've all had to pivot. So how come you can't? Like, and we've had to pivot like right around a sharp corner, like a total U-turn kind of a pivot. We've all had to do that. Not just the lawyers, the people have had to pivot around like the life planning and all this kind of stuff. So the department has to be better, as you say, Raj, like that's totally it. And this email about like, I'm sorry, we can't answer your question because we're dealing with people from Afghanistan. Like, bullshit. I'm sorry, but bullshit. And I just want to be
let's not put this on the people of Afghanistan. They've suffered enough, right? Like, I mean,
and also you're not actually helping them either. Yeah. You're not helping them either. So like, don't tell, I have a bunch of those cases and they won't answer my emails either. So don't tell me that's who you're paying attention to, because I know you're not.
What I love is the email where it says like, our officers don't have any more information than you do regarding processing. I'm like, wow.
That's a problem?
That is a problem.
It's also not true because they have access to GCMS. I've never understood that. Like, they totally do. They just won't share it, which again goes like to the whole, you know, people never cared about the color of the bar. They want to be able to see basically what's in GCMS. And I don't know why the department doesn't. I have more sympathy on the... but the thing is, like, we think that...
My sympathy dried up about... I think maybe 6 months ago. I did have some sympathy too.
Yeah, well, I think that the big thing for the department is, you know, in our own ability to adjust to COVID, we could, and the government did this a bit, slow down intake, whereas the number of new applications that they kept receiving. And I actually think, like, you know, we say that the department hasn't been able to adjust to processing. They, I think, achieved what they wanted, which was their target. Like, that was their starting point, and that's what they planned around. It may look like they're, you know, being impacted by the pandemic or that this is chaotic, but really, like, they achieved their objective. They launched a new program. They hit their targets. If you start from this, is what we want.
Yeah. All right. Yeah, that's fine. If the measurement of success is immigration intake, that's fine. You're right. They did hit their target of 400,000. But it all depends.
Sorry, hold on a second.
You know, if you measure, you know, the ability of a fish to climb a tree, it'll think it's a failure for the rest of its life. It all depends on what your measurement is. Now we took in 400,000 at a cost. There was a cost to many other applicants as well. You did hit your 400,000.
But I think it was deliberate. I don't think it. I think the government could have completely processed those skilled workers in 2021.
No,
that wasn't their goal.
No. And you know what? I would prioritize always applicants that are living, working, studying in Canada over anyone overseas on under the economic class, to be clear. That should have been shifted. CEC should never have been competing with FSW anyway. We should never have deleted the pre-2012 CEC pass-fail and put them in the general pool with FSW. That should never have happened.
Can I give another example of that? Is the caregiver categories, the HCCP and the HSWP, those like two pilots, they also have overseas competing with people who are here and have already done their 2 years of work. And if they give those spots away to the people overseas, those people in Canada cannot get landed and have to continue in that indentured servitude of LMIA-based employment on a fixed employment contract with, like, does the employer want to spend $1,000 on an LMIA application? It's another one.
I don't have sympathy for IRCC at this point. I have a modicum of sympathy of FSWs that have been selected and they're waiting in limbo, and there's just not enough transparency, as Stephen puts it. And thank God for his ATIP efforts, that they now know that it could be a very long wait indeed. I have a great deal of sympathy for family class that are in limbo, that are stuck. Families are being affected. Families are being torn apart. Marriages are failing. Relationships are failing. That is a
kids are suffering.
That is a fail. That is a fail by IRCC.
Yeah. I have a question for you both, though, about the quota thing. Like, is the 400,000 or whatever it is that decisions or is that actual humans?
Humans.
It's humans. Because, I mean, the thing to me, like, I want to take you back to the HCCP, HSWP thing, which is that they say 2750 per year on each of those programs. But I'm getting the most insane refusals. And I think those people took up their spot in the 2750. Like, they hit the target, let's say in March, then they stop accepting applications, and then the refusals come out almost a year later. So, like, the spot is burned for both the overseas person and for the one just trying to regularize her status and bring her family over. They've burned that spot, and then they refuse because, like, literally, for a 3-month period, they called themselves self-employed. And the department says self-employed is not a job description. So they will refuse the application on that basis a year later. And then I have to get this caregiver to finance a federal court judicial review application on her $14 an hour wage, where she's raising the kids and taking care of the elderly person who's, like, in this COVID environment. Like, it's just mental.
So yeah, and to go to your question of that, like, so their target for people under the caregiver programs, agri-food pilot, and rural and northern immigration pilot was 8,500 people. So how that 2,500 applications plays into that, and, you know, how many dependents there are, I'm not sure, but yeah, that's a measurement of people.
It can't be about people, though, because, I mean, it definitely doesn't include their dependents. It's applications they will accept in the door.
Yeah.
But then if 50% of those, and I haven't got the the skill that you do, Steve, to be able to do the appropriate ATIPs to figure out, like, let's get at the quality of the decisions that happened on those 2750 applications brought in. I'm sure there's only maybe of the number that I speak to, a super small margin who can actually have an employer who will pay me to run the judicial review. I don't have the funding to do them all for free, and I have to pay staff. Like, it just, like, it's a problem that is so broken that I think getting beyond that, how many in the door and how many actual decisions that actually brought humans in those programs needs to be broken down better.
Yeah. No, my point is they're clearly planning on a number of refusals, because if you have 2750 plus dependents plus the agri-food pilot, rural and northern immigration pilot, and you're only planning on approving 8,500 people, there's definitely a plan for a certain amount.
Exactly.
Like, they plan on that. Going to the processing times, Raj, another thing you've been tweeting about recently is mandamus, which we did a episode on sometime last year.
Our first mandamus was the Tharg Zaghbib, where I took a mandamus issue to the Federal Court of Appeal.
Yeah, we did an episode.
That was years ago. Yeah.
Third episode. Yeah. But I think you've been filing them more now.
Yeah,
or threatening, at least sending the demand letters.
Yeah, and so bear in mind, again, you pick your battles. So yeah, I did not send a demand. And look, mandamus I've been doing for 10 years plus, and I've used mandamus in a variety of circumstances, including compelling CBSA to investigate marriage fraud. Mandamus is not a great remedy, okay? It's a very, very stratified, it's very sclerotic, it's back, you go back, at the Federal Court of Appeal for Tharg Zaghbib, I was like, this is not a great remedy. It's not like certiorari, it's not like these other things. So mandamus is, you got to fit this sort of square peg, square hole. So I avoided mandamus for more than a year and a half. People were asking me for mandamus demand. We've heard you can do this. And I'm like, no, I'm going to wait. And then all of a sudden the dam burst. And in fact, I think my Twitter followers have leaped since I've been posting, you know, demand, no response, we file, we get a consent, or we get leave. And, you know, so 17 days, the last one was, we made a, filed our record on January 24th or so. We got landing instructions for a nurse, a U.S. nurse who is ready, willing, and able to serve on the front lines of this pandemic, graduated from the U.S., everything set, right to go, came up here, is actually studying in her field as well, paying international fees. So we can't land her. Well, we now did. We did on Saturday.
Mic and scream.
What?
Did you just mute your mic and scream?
Yeah, I have been.
Yeah. So that was the most recent case. So yes, I am now. Now the floodgates are open. Now I don't care. I was very diligent. I was like, I don't think we've got a mandamus. My personal opinion is no mandamus. I don't want to take your money if I don't think I can meet the test. But now, we are meeting the test. We now have delays of landing prior to the pandemic. Prior to, like, this person should have been landed before March 2020, for example. But now, and you know, we're getting leave. We're getting leave from the court. The court is not, responding. The respondent's argument is it's a COVID. It's impacted processing. We just got leave. I have a matter on this. I have to discontinue it because my 58-year-old just got landed under the CEC, so we're discontinuing that as well.
Yeah, I've noticed mandamus has been productive as well. I held off the same way you have, yep. And I'm finding it to be very productive. And also, apparently, they're now getting so many of them that, like, DOJ across the country appear to be working on it. And pulling in, I had a chat with a Department of Justice lawyer, like, they're pulling in lawyers who don't normally do immigration because of the volume that they're getting. Which I don't know how big a wrench this actually throws. Like, when you have a certain number of people that are filing mandamus, how much does this actually impact normal processing times?
It's huge. Just on the DOJ side, my last one where I got leave, they had to get an affidavit from some officer saying, look, I'm reviewing this under, it was an Indian Army guy from 30 years ago. And so they had to review, like, security for Indian Army. I thought this matter was settled 10 plus years ago, but in any event, you know, you're getting affidavits. They're fighting us on some. But mandamus continues to be, will be very, very relevant. The story of 2022, if we're talking about judicial review, the story of 2022 will be mandamus.
Yeah, I think so as well.
A few points here on the mandamus thing, which is that, first of all, is about the delay. And I think that what I'm really kind of grappling with, because, I mean, to me, it is a bit of an ethical quandary. Like, I don't want to bring vexatious litigation. I don't want to bog down the process and all this. I don't want to add to the DOJ problem, which I'll get to in a second. But at the same time, it's not just about the number of months. It's about the impact on that human, given the specific circumstances of that human's life. Like, where 2 years might be a kind of no biggie for somebody who just wants to be able to leisure travel, on somebody who like can't visit family members because of this or can't be with a kid, it's a shorter timeline. And I just don't know if that kind of tethering of the time and the consequences is really there in the way that it needs to be. Raj is looking at me like he doesn't know what I'm talking about. But I just feel like, you know, no, it's sort of been more crude months in the past, I feel.
Mandamus is like using a hammer to kill a mosquito in many times.
But an ineffective hammer, like this goes also to the point about the inefficacy of the remedy.
You probably would not use a mandamus for outstanding TRV, for example, because you're asking for refusal. You'd
right,
use
exactly.
that, you'd use, because that's the easiest way to exercise discretion. Okay, no, I'm not satisfied. Done. Now what are you going to do?
Yeah, exactly.
So mandamus, again, you pick and choose. It'll probably be a PR. It'll probably be citizenship. It is probably going to be tied to some objective sort of criteria, which is some kind of posted processing times, some kind of you know, some kind of determination pre-pandemic, perhaps, right? You know,
and I'm assuming
I would probably say mandamus for PR somewhere over 18 months or so. So that's just somewhere over 18 months or so. But let's put it this way.
Three times the stated processing is usually the
I wouldn't go that far anymore.
And there's no such thing, I believe. Now the bar is, I think that vexatious mandamus are few and far between. Who's going to pay you for a mandamus, a demand, whatever? They self-select. You are going to get, most applicants are going to be waiting around. They're going to give them the year. You know, a couple of expired medicals. Okay. You know, around 18 months or so is when you start thinking about mandamus seriously.
Well, and so the other thing with the skilled worker applications is a lot of times it seems like they've all been processed. They're just not being finalized. So you mentioned with the TRV, they could just refuse it. With these skilled workers, it seems to literally be just a question of pushing a button. And I think that button wasn't pushed before because they were prioritizing CEC to hit their numbers. But like, as far as, you know, going before the federal, like in terms of DOJ, whether you settle and just tell IRCC to approve the thing or go before a judge, do you really want to go before a judge with an application where the GCMS notes all say it's been approved and it's just been sent waiting to be landed? I had that tweet. I can't remember.
Remember one thing. They used ministerial instructions when they trashed the pre-2008 FSW applications.
Yeah.
Okay. So they used the ministerial instructions, trashed this. Okay, done. They brought in express entry thinking that 80% were going to finalize in 6 months. So mandamus is very suited for express entry work because they trashed. We couldn't use this on the ministerial instructions. We couldn't JR this stuff on the ministerial instructions. And you trashed 800,000 applicants or 600,000 applications, but you can't use those ministerials. You might be able to use ministerial instructions right now, and that might happen. You might say, you know what, we're going to restrict FSWs to 10,000 per year, or we're not going to take any more FSW under express entry.
Yeah. The department isn't making it easy on themselves. Like, I just went to the IRCC check processing times website, select an application type, economic immigration. Which type, federal skilled worker, have you already applied? I already applied. 6 months. And like, there's, I mean, mandamus is in part based on what are their normal processing times. And if the IRCC website, and they continue to say it should be 6 months, and it's actually, you know, as per that memo, that
and you should be able to rely on the
two years to 3 years. Yeah.
I think so. I mean, when we were talking about where do I still have sympathy or empathy, whatever we're going to call it, I still have empathy for the DOJ. And I actually have growing empathy for the DOJ. I would love to be on a fly on the wall in some of those conversations between the DOJ lawyers and their client trying to get instructions about these mandamus applications. Because, like, imagine if you're the lawyer and your client has this decision on the books in GCMS saying we're approved, but now you're still waiting for a year. And DOJ is like, why are you wasting my time? Yeah. Just paper that decision so that I can move on to real litigation.
We have a fair group out in Alberta. So a lot of counsel.
They're in BC too. We have wonderful DOJ.
You know, like, so obviously whoever I encountered at my, the litigation we talked about wasn't in Alberta.
Right.
But yeah,
my understanding also, though, that DOJ is dealing with certain individuals in private practice who have commoditized JRs and mandamus and are filing applications that have nothing personalized, just hoping
like a chatbot.
Yeah, like they just file the initial application and don't do anything with it in the hopes that
I say to those people, please stop. You're breaking the.
But they're like, well, and so I've heard that a couple of DOJ lawyers say this is that it's being just sold as something like, oh, we can file an ATIP, we can file a JR and see what happens with no intention of applicants' records, no intention. Well, that's the big one of applicants' records, and it's just clogging the system.
Statutory limit on replying to an ATIP. And if they were meeting that rather than requesting extensions every single time, then those would not turn into JR. So again, I understand that some advocates have this attitude this approach to lawyering that you keep knocking on the door every time until they answer it. But at the same time, it's causing so much push along effects because let's say you have a really legitimate JR that's maybe not even a mandamus, but the Department of Justice in Vancouver, at least in my experience, they can't read the file until like maybe a day or 2 days before their reply deadline, which means that they can't settle, even though if they had 2 weeks to get instructions from their client, they would have been able to. But their own personal inventory is so high right now because of this, like, you know, this new manifestation of what is really an ATIP request now being processed by the Department of Justice. It means that by the time they get to your file, it's too late for them to have a meaningful conversation with their client, especially when they're in a different time zone.
I believe the court is, we've got some instructions. I've got like 8 JRs in the next 1 to 2 months. And so like, I believe they're trying to force the parties to kind of come to a decision on consent prior to the hearing.
There's a new practice direction, I think, where the DOJ actually has to paper, like, I have looked at this. I am not going to settle with you.
Because, sometimes they're settling with us like 2 days prior to the hearing. Well, that's not very fair. We're ready to go.
No, it's not. They've already spent all their money by then. Yeah. Or not all of it, but a whole lot of money.
No, but we're ready to go. I'd rather get a decision. And, I've resisted consents from DOJ before. A risky strategy, but I've resisted consents in the past. And I've been successful at it. You take that risk and you say, I want the draw. I want to see what I get out of
it. But I've seen when you've tried to refuse consent, and sometimes they bring a motion for a directed verdict, like for a summary judgment or whatever it's called. I can't even remember.
You could resist the motion as well, but.
Again, it's just a lot more money and time. Yeah. It's just like, I don't know if I can suggest that as a viable strategy to my client. I mean, I'm pissed about it, but that doesn't mean that they need to pay for that.
It hasn't been clear to me where the federal court is coming from, because they keep using that term settle. And as one DOJ lawyer told me, like, this isn't like a monetary amount that we're trying to calculate. It's either the application is either the person, basically, as they put it, either the person can come to Canada or they can't. And as long as, there's federal court dismissals are still the majority, I think. I don't fully see where there's pressure on DOJ to settle more.
Close the loop on this mandamus thing, though. I think that I want to go back to what Raj said about the inefficacy of the remedy, too, because, like, there's something more there. Because, like, when you win, and I put that in air quotes for those people that can't see me on screen, is, like, when you win a mandamus, that might just be like because you settled because they've started doing something. It doesn't necessarily mean they finished doing something. And so the idea that it's just some legitimate movement on the file is kind of like, I would love some guidance from Raj about like, what do you do now they've started processing? Do you withdraw or do you still hold the JR there?
You know, and I tell my clients this, and I'm paraphrasing Jerry Seinfeld on this, but mandamus is sometimes like tipping over a vending machine or breaking up with your girlfriend. You may not be able to do it on that first go around. You might have to, you know, you do the mandamus, they take a meaningful step, or they, you know, ideally, like, for example, my client gets landed, last two got just get landed, or they take a meaningful step, or they tell you like, oh, actually, you know what, we just need this one thing. And so you would discontinue, you would then diarize it, and then you do it again, you do another demand. And so I've done a mandamus for one client, I've done it three times. And each time I get some movement, then it gets stalled again, then I do another mandamus, then I get some movement, then I do another one. And so sometimes on the rare occasion, you might have to do multiple mandamus applications. There again, you're tipping over a vending machine, you're chopping down a tree, whatever, you use whatever analogy you want to use. But and the beauty of mandamus is that there's no prejudice. You can discontinue and do it again.
Yeah. No, we have where like we file the mandamus and then 10 days later, there's a request for an updated job offer and the client provides that same day and we don't bother discontinuing. We just keep it going and saying,
you don't discontinue in that case because according to jurisprudence and I believe Justice Russell and Ovalle is that it locks in, it's frozen. Once you file that mandamus, subsequent steps should not be, again, new evidence shouldn't be in play. Yeah. But
and for the most part, I'm finding the same thing as you.
If I knew the citation off the top of my head, that would be impressive.
Oh, I don't mean like that. I mean new email.
I wish I
had that brain. Oh my God.
I was like, wow. Like, no, it's Justice Russell and Ovalle. Ovalle. Yeah.
Okay, that's all we need.
Do you think, because I'm seeing a lot of chatter about whether processing will return to normal, do you see there being a new normal when this pandemic's over? Like, do we go back to federal skilled worker and CEC being in the same draw 6 months?
No.
Is the future of these TRPR pathways?
Yes.
I went on someone else's, a consultant show named Ask Kubir, and I kind of made the same point that you guys did, which is I have much more sympathy for the people inside Canada than the federal skilled worker applicants. Who are outside, or especially those who are just in the pool, and that I believe politicians will also. And I got a bit raked over the coals as an anti-FSW-er for that. But do you see?
Why would we select a 32-year-old botanist from Pune?
We're gonna get hate mail.
Got a 25-year-old Punjabi guy making $80,000 a year in Canada. Count me. I'm with you, brother. The new normal is we should never have put the CECs and the FSWs in the same category. The future is CECs. The future is these TR to PR pathways. That is the future. The FSWs are going to be an add-on. Historically, the FSW started about 50 years ago or so. It was the most popular, let's say, oversubscribed model of economic immigration. Now that you have a constant intake of international students and temporary foreign workers, there's absolutely very little justification for the FSW to remain as the default route for economic immigration to Canada. The future is going to be employer-driven. It's going to be PNPs. It's going to be CCs. It's going to be TR-to-PR pathways. That is the new normal.
No, I totally get it. But this is where I get super political. And it's partially because, it's because of my ties to the caregiver community, which is that I understand that TR to PR is kind of the way that they're going, but what they've always said to me is the reason we can't land caregivers, nurses, like those kinds of people from abroad is that, it's mostly about caregivers. If you bring in the caregivers, they, as permanent residents, will they actually work as caregivers? And so, but the problem here is that if like the forcing them to come in as TRs and then to work in this indentured servitude kind of model until they've earned the right to apply for permanent residency. And actually they've entirely closed down the possibility of somebody coming into Canada as a TR right now as a caregiver. So you have to apply through the PR. Like, this is part that, like, I get these emails all the time. Like, a caregiver from abroad cannot apply for a work permit anymore. There's a refusal to process ministerial instruction. So they cannot. So unless we have enough within our existing labor market pool, either Canadians or people here on work permits, like, there's no option for them to do that. So it's, again, like, this is where the strategic planning hasn't been thought through, because, like, if you say it's all those in Canada, then we're going, like, this is why I've said since the beginning, since the introduction of the HCCP and the HSWP, they're killing the caregiver program. This is just a more apolitical way of doing it.
Well, they've been killing killing the program for a number of years now.
Well, they've been killing the people up until now. Now they're actually going to, they have been, like, the way that it was before with the abuse, and you must live in the house, and it's going to take you 6 years to become a permanent resident. And in that time, you just have to keep working at this role, even if you have a nursing degree. And, you know, in that amount of time, you're going to get to the point that you can't even reawaken your nursing credentials because you haven't been working as a nurse for so long. Like, it's just, so they've been killing the people, but now they're making it so they can't even come in.
Yeah. Raj, I see you've got a meeting to run to. Before you go, where can people contact you on Twitter, all those FSWs in the pool, to convince you why they should take priority? It's like the Spider-Man meme, right? Everyone pointing at each other when all they could do is just increase numbers.
It's at imlawyer, I-M-M, Lawyer Canada is my Twitter handle, and website is sshlaw.ca. But this has always been fun. I really enjoy my time. I always learn something new. And I think we could talk, we could spend at least another hour on this. But thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Raj. You, like, seriously broke my brain with all of that wisdom. So thank you for that.
I always learned something from you, Deanna and Steve. Thanks a lot. Take care.
All right. Bye.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Want to get a chiseled look in the jawline? Sculpt and shape your jawline with added volume from Juvederm Volux XC. Juvederm Volux XC is an injectable gel specifically designed to be robust enough to improve moderate to severe loss of jawline definition. And it is the first and only hyaluronic acid filler approved for the jawline. Add volume to your jawline for a chiseled look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you. Visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com.